Welcome to episode 3 of the Women in the Can competition season of the Seventh Row podcast. I am your host, Orla Smith, executive editor of Seventh Row, and I'm joined by my co-host, Alex Heaney, editor-in-chief of Seventh Row.
Hello.
This year is the first year that Cannes has put 5 films directed by women in competition, more than any previous year. They're still far from gender parity, but we wanted to take this opportunity to celebrate the wonderful women filmmakers and their films that have been feted by the competition both this year and in the past. This week, we're going to talk about the French filmmaker Céline Sciamma, who we love, and her history with Cannes. Her most recent film, Petite Maman, screened at Berlin in 2021, but her previous and still most famous film, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, screened in the Cannes competition in 2019, where it won the screenplay prize. We have one final episode coming up on June 1st, in which we'll talk about Japanese filmmaker Naomi Kawase, who has screened at Cannes more times than any other woman. And there's still time to catch up with our first 2 episodes of this season. Episode 1 gives a breakdown of the Cannes Film Festival, how it works, and its history of programming women directors, or not programming them. And episode 2 dives deep into Kelly Reichardt, her work, and her history with Cannes. Her new film Showing Up is screening in this year's competition on Friday. So you can listen to those on our podcast feed, or they'll be linked in the show notes for this episode. We have with us today our guest, who was also on our previous episode, Lindsay Pugh.
Hello.
I mean, Lindsay sort of found us right around the time when our Céline Sciamma book came out. Not through the Sciamma book, right? But that was pretty much the same month.
I think so. That's right. And then I reviewed the book on my website. Yeah, it's weird to think that that was only 2 years ago somehow, and not 25.
Yeah. So as we just mentioned, in 2020, we wrote a book on all of Céline Sciamma's work called Portraits of Resistance, The Cinema of Céline Sciamma. It's available as an ebook at sciammabook.com. And you can also get our Céline Sciamma page 28 mug to sip from while you read the book, which is also available at that same URL. And they'll both be in the show notes. It's an essential companion to Portrait of a Lady on Fire and The Essential Guide to Céline Sciamma, full of interviews with her, with the actors in Portrait of a Lady on Fire, Adèle Haenel and Naomi Melan. And we've also got an interview with the sound editor on the film, Valerie Deleuf, which is really fascinating, and essays on all her films. So take a look at that at sciammabook.com. More on that later.
And I will just say that the Sciamma book is excellent for anyone, again, like with the Kelly Reichardt book, who wants to learn more about her process. There are some really excellent interviews with her, one on girlhood that is particularly enlightening, and there are also some really great essays, and I always love the scene analysis that is in the Seventh Row books. Yeah, that's especially good in this book, especially if you have not recently seen the films. I always feel like that helps bring me back into the mindset that I was in when I saw the films. So for each of her films, there is a really good breakdown that kind of reminds me of the New York Times Anatomy of a Scene. And I would just say it's a really good comprehensive look at her as a filmmaker, some of her frequent collaborators, and gives a great overview on process. And I remember really enjoying Lena wrote an essay in that book on Tomboy that was very good. And someone else wrote an essay on Water Lilies. So just everything in the book is excellent. It will remind you of why you like Céline Sciamma so much. And it's the kind of thing you could just sit down and read in one sitting, which most film books are not like that.
So what's the best way to introduce Céline Sciamma? I mean, we can say that she's made 5 feature films so far, and I think we all think that all 5 are pretty excellent.
That seems like an understatement.
Yeah, we did write a book about them.
We put like 2 of her films on our top 50 films of the 2010s.
Yeah, and I think that whenever a best of the decade list is due for this decade, Petite Maman certainly will be in contention for a place. So she's like one of a generation of filmmakers who went to the La Femme French film school.
Right. Oh yeah, fun fact, she was there at the same time as Eskil Vogt.
Yeah, and I mean there's all sorts of, like, you know, all the, like, younger generation of French filmmakers who are, like, coming up right now, like, you look at their Wikipedia and it's like, oh, you went to La Femme, and you went to La Femme as well. Like, Julia Ducournau was there, I think, and Alice Winocur.
Yeah, it's like the Rada of filmmaking in France.
Yeah.
Or I guess you could even say in Europe, it's one of the big sort of European film schools.
Water Lilies was, I think, her, was it like her graduation screenplay? Am I remembering that right?
I think so.
I know Augustine was Alice Winocur's. I don't know if this was hers, but it would make sense that it.
Let me do some Googling. It doesn't say whether she went to La Femme for screenwriting, but I'd kind of assume that if, oh, there, yeah, it was her, she wrote Water Lilies as part of her final evaluation at La Femme.
Then probably she was there for screenwriting. I don't think you would have done that if you were in directing.
Well, she says, actually, it says, Siama has stated that she had never planned on directing and that she had thought only about screenwriting or working as a critic because she felt that directing was too much of a male-only position. So, yeah, she studied screenwriting at La Femme.
Well, that seems to be a common story, because that's Alice Winocur's story too, isn't it? That she, like, she wasn't planning to direct her first feature, Augustine, but she couldn't find anyone to direct it.
So she directed it herself.
And of course, she's a fantastic director. And so, thank goodness she didn't find somebody else to direct it, which I guess is true of Celine Sciamma too. But that's certainly true of that generation, I suppose, was the idea that women can write. And we'll be talking about this too, and certainly as far as how Celine Sciamma has been thought of and awarded.
Yes, that's a big discussion, the idea of, like, women as directors versus screenwriters, and we will be getting to it later. But she's also, I mean, Celine Sciamma, you know, she's directed 5 features, but she's also worked separately as a screenwriter. She worked on the screenplays of films like My Life as a Zucchini and Being 17 and Paris 13th District, all of which she didn't direct. So she has a career as a screenwriter outside of the film she directs as well.
Slight sidetrack from Celine Sciamma, but just maybe some interesting facts, because this is a Women at Cannes season, that her, one of the other co-writers on Paris 13th District, which was in competition last year, was Léa Missius, who has a film in Director's Fortnight this year. Kind of interesting that you can write a film for a man and get in competition, but you make your, you direct your own film and you end up in Director's Fortnight. And Alice Winocur, who's a pretty interesting comparison for Celine Sciamma, because they have some similar interests, and also they share a ton of collaborators, including their editor, Julien Lacheret, who is a wonderful character. But Alice Winocur is also at Cannes this year and in the Director's Fortnight, not in competition.
Mm-hmm. Although, to be fair to Léa Missius, she has been equal opportunity screwed over, because she also wrote on the screenplay for Claire Denis' The Stars at Noon.
Oh, seriously? So, oh, wow.
Yeah, okay. So she's now been in competition twice as a co-writer, but she still doesn't get a competition slot herself. And she has to piggyback on Claire Denis waiting like 30 plus years to get another competition slot.
I mean, it is her second feature, and maybe she didn't want to screen in a Certain Regard, which, fair play, I think it's a shitty launch.
Yeah, I mean, but I think that she's, like, given the sort of clout she's managed to gather as a screenwriter, and the fact that, like, Julia Ducournau's second feature played in competition, you know, it's
But Ra made a much bigger splash than Ava, which nobody but you and I saw,
although it did launch a career.
Anyway, sorry,
yes, back to Celine Sciamma. She her history with Cannes began in 2007 with Water Lilies, which was in the En Certain Regard section of Cannes. So she's been around Cannes since the very beginning of her career. But Tomboy, her second film, played in Berlin.
Yeah.
I don't believe that would have been in competition.
I think it was in competition.
Hmm, interesting.
Well, that makes sense, right? Because it's a film about young children, and Berlin mm-hmm. has a vested interest in programming films about young people. They have an entire sidebar generation. I believe she played in competition for that, but regardless, like, it's a much friendlier space for those kinds of yeah. stories. And it was a queer story, so also a friendlier space. It's interesting that that's kind of where she took that film. I think it was a wise move.
Yeah. And, well, but she played Petite Maman in Berlin as well, which is also a film about children. I think the thinking is that Berlin is going to take that kind of story a little bit more seriously than Cannes is going to. Although they still didn't give her any awards, which is, I'm still a little bit annoyed about, but nevertheless.
It won the Teddy Awards, though, at Berlin. It got, or well, no, it didn't win. I guess it won, yeah.
Oh, sorry. I was thinking of Petite Maman, which did that win the Teddy Award?
No. No.
But yeah, she went from Berlin competition to being in what sidebar was Girlhood?
Well, so this is actually quite funny because given the books we've written, Girlhood was actually opening night or opening day of the director's fortnight, and it was up against Mike Leigh's Mr. Turner. And I was at Cannes that year. I got up super early. I got turned away from the Mr. Turner screening, and I was kind of happy about it because it meant I could go see Girlhood. And, well, we did end up writing a book about Mike Leigh. Just, like, in a funny
Yeah, no shade fate. To Mr. Turner.
Yeah, no, but I, not my favorite Mike Leigh, and I definitely love Girlhood. So that was a happy move. But so that's actually, like, a big deal to get the, like, opening slot. It's hard to know what kind of politicking went into that. Like, did she submit to the official? She probably submitted to the official selection. They probably were like, we'll put you in Sultan Ragar instead. And Director's Fortnight was like, actually, we think you're great and we'll take you. And that happens a lot yeah. with a lot of filmmakers. And
I mean, yeah, that sounds likely because having been in Berlin competition and played at Cannes before, she could well have been due for a competition slot. Like,
oh, absolutely.
If all was fair and Girlhood yeah. being a fantastic film. So I think she has a right to be a bit like, no, I'm going to Director's Fortnight instead.
But Naomi Kawase had a film that year, so there weren't a lot of slots for women in the competition.
And then finally she got that competition slot with yeah. her fourth feature, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which was, I believe, about 5 years after Girlhood. Yeah. So it had been quite a while between films, and that film, like, completely
She spent a lot of time writing screenplays in between then.
Yeah. But yeah, that film blew up in a way that no one really expected. We had kind of decided we were writing this book about her, and then...
Yeah, before Portrait even came out, we were like,
yeah,
Celine Sciamma book is coming, we're just waiting for the next film. And then we were like, oh, I don't think we even realized how popular it was until the book was written.
Lucky for us, yeah. Twitter and Tumblr and Reddit and all the best places on the internet became obsessed with it, and people were interested in reading our book, which we didn't think would be the case because Sciamma had always been sort of underrated yeah. up until that point, and now she is sort of a beloved force in the international art house cinema scene.
I think her films were really misunderstood too, because they were being reviewed and decided upon by male critics. Like, I remember when Tomboy came out, I thought it was such a smart and thoughtful film, and I went looking for reviews, and first of all, you couldn't find anything more than 300 words, and then second of all, even for then, it was like pretty insensitive, ignorant ideas about gender identity. Like, half the reviews called Laura lesbian. Some of them were just like, oh, she's just a tomboy. None of them seemed to understand that the film was about gender nonconformity, which, like, even in 2012, I guess, when it came out, like, I know that was, you know, that was the dark ages compared to now, but even still, like, I feel like I was way less informed then, and I knew that it was about gender nonconformity. Yes. And I was really disappointed by how poor, like, just how little thought went into it. I think that was maybe a, you know, I guess similar to Alice Winokur, right? Like, her film Augustine, which is about The Female Gaze, which Portrait of a Lady on Fire is also about, but she made Augustine in
2012,
right. So she was 7 years ahead of Siama on that particular... I mean, Siama had been doing stuff about The Female Gaze. It just wasn't, like, the center of her story.
They're both Portrait and Augustine are, like, explicitly films about, like, an artist and a muse, yeah. But in one case it's a doctor and a patient, but it kind of plays with, like, sort of artist and muse dynamic, in which the idea of the muse as powerless is kind of subverted, mm-hmm. and it plays with, like, the female gaze and the male gaze in a very explicit way by, like, taking the dynamic of, like, the person who is looked at and the person who orchestrates them. It's interesting that they have the same editor, and Alex asked him about the experience of editing both those films, and he kind of echoed that idea, and we'll link to that interview in the show notes, but he echoed that idea that, like, Alice Winnicott was kind of doing that back in 2012, and I think now with Portrait people are ready to sort of, like, recognize that in the film and celebrate it in a way that Augustine didn't get appreciated for back in 2012.
Yeah, I know, you can kind of see that with all of Siama's films in a way, like, you know, like, you think about how Palm Trees and Power Lines was kind of embraced at Sundance this year, and that's about a young girl getting groomed for sexual abuse by a 30-something man. And Water Lilies is, like, kind of about that, but it's a little bit less, the abuse is less overt, and it's much more about, like, the patriarchal structures. And you could see, like, people can barely deal with that stuff now. Look at Promising Young Woman. That's our idea of dealing with patriarchy. So you can see, like, it's probably still super ahead of its time, but in 2007? And I mean, also, you think about who would have been writing about those films. Like, there's a lack of women critics now, but in 2007, it was extra bleak. Like, you can see how a film like that could pass under the radar. And I think I only got turned on to Celine Sciamma because I happened to have a screener for it when it played at the French Film Festival in Toronto. And then, of course, I was floored and an immediate Celine Sciamma fan, I will see everything you ever make person, but it could just as easily have been a film I never saw at all.
Yeah, so many people just will not watch if the critical reception is bad, and when the critical reception is overwhelmingly men who don't understand female experiences, then there you have it.
Yeah, I'm not even sure that the reception was bad. It just wasn't
overwhelmingly
ecstatic. Yeah. I don't think that the critical reception was necessarily bad to the point that, like, people would have been interested and then they read the reviews and then weren't. It probably just didn't get enough attention, period, and then the reviews weren't ecstatic enough. Like, I think it's a different situation from, say, like, Louder Than Bombs, which went to the competition to die.
I would just like to issue a correction. I've just looked it up, and Tomboy was in Forum, not in competition.
Oh, that's so interesting. I'm surprised it was in Forum.
Oh, sorry, not Forum. Panorama.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. I said Forum. What were we talking about? Oh, yes, her films being misunderstood.
Yeah, I mean, she was saying quite complex things about sort of gender and patriarchy before the film world was, like, recognizing that kind of filmmaking as important. And I think that's why it took until her fourth film, you know, 12 years into her career, for her to be recognized as this important auteur.
Well, and that film also kind of helps you. Like, I don't want to say, I don't mean that it's simplistic or panders, because it isn't, but it's a film that says, hi, I'm about the gaze. Think about how you're looking and watching this. Like,
the G-A-Z-E.
Yeah, yes, well, I suppose both. But, like, the film does explicitly give you cues about how to read it.
I mean, like, there's discussions, explicit discussions about, like, Orpheus and, like, things that are, like, very related to the... I mean, there's, like, the characters discuss their situation in philosophical terms within the film itself.
I think you're a bit more on your own with her other films. Like, I loved Girlhood the first time I saw it, but I think I really underrated it. I didn't totally get it until I saw it a second time. I think it's a lot easier mm-hmm. to kind of get Portrait on the first viewing. You know, you rewatch it and you'll get way more depth, and there's it's certainly not a film that you watch once and you're done with. But I think you could probably, A, we were in a place where we could read those stories better, and B, it helps you a little bit more. As compared to, like, Water Lilies, like, I remember when I saw that, I'd never seen anything like that. That was so in tune mm-hmm. to, like, girls' bodies and our experience in the world and how men look at us, but not being about the men, but about how our lives get, like, end up revolving around male opinion and patriarchal opinion. And that was so radical. I remember I saw that, like, that movie destroyed me. But I could see, like, I saw it and was like, oh, I see my own experiences in that. But if you, you know, in heightened or different ways, like, obviously I didn't have those specific experiences, but I had versions of them. But I could see, like, especially if you're a man, you watch that, you're like, I don't know what it's like to be, you know, busty and be considered fat. You know what I mean? Like,
I don't know what it's like to be busty. When I think, like, Portrait is a more easily lovable film than some of her other films too, because it's like it's a very sweeping romance. I mean, she's talked explicitly about being inspired by the structure of Titanic, which is, you know, one of the most profitable films of all time, for a reason. And so it's very easy to really fall for that film, whereas I think all of those films portray, like, harsh patriarchal realities, but there's the, you get the sweetness of the romance that tempers that in Portrait that makes it more sort of, like, beautiful to experience. Whereas with Water Lilies and Tomboy and Girlhood, the harsh realities are kind of much harsher. They're harder to, like, leave, like, glowing, where, because, like, the end, like, Girlhood has many, like, beautiful moments, but we leave the protagonist in quite a harsh place. And same with the first two films, there's so much harshness in them.
Yeah.
Which isn't not the case with Portrait, but again, the love story threads throughout in a way that makes you swoon as well.
Right. I guess in our book on Celine Sciamma, Portraits of Resistance, I wrote an essay called Temporary Utopias in a, actually, I don't remember exactly what it was called, in a harsh world or something like that, or a patriarchal world?
In an unjust
world. There you go. I guess all synonyms in the end. But yeah, it was kind of about how her films are about what it's like to live under patriarchy. But the difference with those earlier films is that most of the film is about, like, the psychological effects of that and what it's like to live through it. And then there are moments of grace and joy and utopia, but they are fleeting and much, like, they aren't most of the film. And that's true of her first three films, that there are there are incredibly joyful, wonderful moments. They're just very short-lived. Whereas Portrait is about, like, the entire film is about one of those joyful moments. But it keeps you aware of how this can't last forever and how this moment is actually only happening because of patriarchal forces, and it's also those that are going to rip them apart. So it just sort of, like, lets you lavish in those moments because the whole film is that, even though the film, like, the outside world seeps into it. And I mean, her other film, her most recent film, Petite Maman, is kind of similar. Like, it starts off by telling you about, like, this is a movie that's dealing with grief and, like, the unknowability of a parent. And it starts off quite sad. But then most of the film is this, like, temporary utopia of what if you could kind of, like, go back in time and get to know your mother as a child and be friends with your mother when she was the same age as you. And get a chance to say goodbye to your grandmother who died without you being able to say goodbye to her. And so then, like, that's a film where, like, it has the same kind of melancholy as all the other films, but, like, Portrait, it kind of extends that kind of uncommon good experience is what the entire movie is about. And the sort of the rest of the tough parts of the world are kind of, like, seeping in, as opposed to the first three films, which I think are more gosh, the world is unjust and terrible, but occasionally something nice happens.
I do wonder if seeing Portrait and then going back and seeing her other films is disappointing for people, or if it is illuminating for people because it gives them a better sense of how to read her work.
I mean, I don't have a sense because I obviously saw her films in order as they came out. But when I rewatched them, I didn't go, well, this kind of sucked now that I've seen Portrait. Like, that was not my response. It was more, oh, wow, there's all kinds of stuff in here that I didn't get when I was 20 that I get now.
Yeah. I think I wonder if people might find them a bit more challenging or be not disappointed by them, but like take a second to sort of come to terms with the fact that they're not, again, they're not as romantic as Portrait. And I don't really have experience with that because I saw them all before Portrait. Yeah. I was an OG fan.
Well, they're also not as... I say this like almost like openly queer. Like, if what you liked about Portrait of a Lady on Fire, I think what a lot of people liked about it was like this open queer romance. It kind of hit a lot of the same nerves as Call Me by Your Name. Then you go back to Water Lilies and there is a queer character in there, but it's not, and you know, obviously Celine Sciamma is a queer filmmaker and is going to have a queer perspective, but like the film is not a film about queerness. That's just, like, one of the components.
She's interested in gender and sexuality in all of them. But none of her first three films are queer romances. They're more interested in the concepts of gender, sexuality, and patriarchy.
Well, and also now that transgender identity and trans rights and transphobia are more mainstream ideas or well-known, I could see people going back to Tomboy and being frustrated, like... Well, it's a trans kid and why won't they just like label them as such? Also could be upset about, because, you know, it was a girl who played Lore, was an actress. I mean, obviously, like, whatever, in France they're still doing this. They're not casting trans actors.
Noémie Merlant.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that. But also Lucas Daunt's film Girl, and he's in competition, I think, this year.
Rewarded for that film.
And that was only a couple of years ago that he was like, yes, let's just cast a cis girl as a transgender girl, and that's totally
fine. I think
fine.
It was a cis boy.
Oh, was it? Oh, you're probably right.
Yeah, I think he cast a cis boy as a trans girl, which is even worse. And I mean, I've seen that film and it's a lot, I mean, it's a lot more aggressive than Tomboy. Let me say, which, like, Tomboy gets away with some things by being a little less specific about Lore's identity. The labels aren't put on Lore. It leaves sort of room for, like, a butch lesbian, for example, to, like, project her experience onto the film, and it leaves room for a non-binary trans person or a trans masculine person to, like, project their experiences onto the film because of that non-specificity. And that's, like, helped the film to age better than some other films from the same era. Because it's about, like, the concepts of how gender nonconformity is, like, received by society more than it is saying Lore is this thing. It's about how society reacts to that.
I think in a way we're more comfortable. We would be more comfortable with the story. Like, we as a society, not, like, the three of us on this podcast, but like in a way, if you just have a character who's a trans character and a kid, like, that's easier because at least now you fit into a binary. And Lore is complicated because we don't know, is Lore gender nonconforming, is Lore transgender or a tomboy, or, and like, what are the forces that are pushing Lore in one direction or the other? Are those Lore themselves, or is it the ways in which girls versus boys are treated? Which I think is something we don't talk about. Like, you know, we don't want to invalidate trans people's experiences. It's a tough situation because I think it's easier to... Now that people are like, oh yeah, I know what a transgender person is. Like, the idea of having to live in the ambiguity is scarier for, like, liberals than it is, like, oh, okay, you're just trans, and then now I have a slot I can put you into. Tomboy is all about the fact that there isn't a slot that Laura fits into, obviously. Or if there is, Laura hasn't figured that out yet.
In 2020, we wrote a book on all of Celine Sciamma's work called Portraits of Resistance, The Cinema of Celine Sciamma. It's available as an ebook at sciammabook.com. Here's what critics had to say about Portraits of Resistance. Alfred Soto, a film critic, said, "Erudite and casual, Portraits of Resistance will force readers into running back to watch every Sciamma film to see what they missed." From Andrew Kendall of Sabroek News, we have an easily accessible guide to thinking on Sciamma's first four feature-length films. And Sheila Rowan-Legg of Screen Anarchy said, "A cornerstone for future Sciamma scholarship." You can get your copy at sciammabook.com, and you can also get our Celine Sciamma page 28 mug to sip from while you read the book. It's also available at that address. Portraits of Resistance, the Cinema of Celine Sciamma, is an essential companion to Portrait of a Lady on Fire and the essential guide to Celine Sciamma. It contains interviews with the cast and crew of Portrait, as well as essays on the film and Celine Sciamma's body of work leading up to Portrait. It also identifies key themes throughout her work that show up again in her most recent film, Petite Maman. This is the first book ever published to be dedicated entirely to Sciamma's work, and it's the only non-academic book on her work to date. She's been making amazing films for over a decade now, which we talk about in this episode, so we're proud to honour her work in this way. So again, you can get your copy of the book at sciammabook.com, or you can get it as part of the Women at Cannes box set that we're selling at the moment, which includes books on Kelly Reichardt, Celine Sciamma, and Lynn Ramsey. That's 7th-row.com/womenatcannesboxset. Enjoy the rest of the episode.
I think this was discussed. Was it discussed on an interview in the book somewhere where she talks about choreographing the breath work in Portrait of a Lady on Fire? And just how she's, I think, one of the rare filmmakers who's able to have a really distinct, precise vision and then execute on it perfectly to the point where I never would have noticed that as a viewer at all. But it is part of what is making the film so evocative and precise and painterly and adding layers of metaphor and meaning. But it's things that are just totally invisible until they're brought to your attention. And that to me is always just a very special treat as a viewer, to find a filmmaker like that and then to learn about their process. And the fact that she is able to carry through on her vision like that says a lot about her ability and the very smart way in which she works.
Yeah, I think also I recall with Portrait, like the shots were extreme, like the framing was extremely, extremely precise. And the actors were talking about how, like, they could not move their head or they would be out of the light.
I don't even know how you can, like, have such a clear view of the big picture of your film that you know, like, the rhythm of the breaths that need to be there, but somehow she is able to, like, hold all those details in her mind at once while also, like, presenting them in a film in a way that doesn't feel, like, contrived and controlled. Like, it is controlled, but it feels natural and it has a rhythm to it.
Although I will say the flip side of that is I think a lot of the best directors do that. I mean, just thinking about the breath alone, like when I talked to Patricia Rosema, Amy Nussbaum, and Nora Sadava about Mouthpiece, they were talking about learning in the editing process that it makes such a huge difference between if you cut before a breath or after a breath. And when I talked to Andrew Haig about, well, we were talking about Weekend, but it ended up being kind of a career interview. He was talking about choreographing the final scene of the Looking movie and telling Raoul to hold his breath until the very end of the scene and let it out then. And that would create a certain kind of tension. I mean, I think that being able to work that way with breathing, and Sam also was also choreographing the footsteps on this, is like an uncommon skill to understand the need for that kind of precise direction. and how that's going to play out, but it does seem to be, like, she's not the only one who does that, and it does seem to be a common trait of, like, great directors. Well, and also, I mean, we're talking a bit about how Portrait was made in her other films, because she was working with children, couldn't be made that way. They were much more improvisational.
Improvisational.
Like, if you watch, I was watching the special features on the Tomboy DVD, and you can see, like, there's a making of featurette, and they're on the set doing, I think, one of the scenes between Lore and the friend Lisa, is that her name, the girl, and you can hear Siama just, like, giving them instructions on screen, like, turn around or start dancing, no, have more fun. Like, I can't remember exactly what it was, but, like, she was talking to them as they were doing things, which, you know, would not be happening on the Portrait set.
I mean, one thing we said we wanted to talk about earlier was sort of, like, the way Siama is seen as a director versus as a screenwriter, and how that's maybe connected to, like, the history of, like, the way she and other women are treated by the film industry and by institutions like Cannes. Because to me, like, for all the reasons you just described, Siama, like, she's so visually distinctive.
Yeah.
She's such a strong direct, like, authorial voice as a director. And she's also a brilliant screenwriter. But that's not necessarily, like, I think personally, I think of her as a director than a screenwriter. I think those things work together in tandem. But strangely enough, she hasn't necessarily been seen that way historically. I mean, she works as a screenwriter outside of her directing duties. And she actually won the Screenplay Award at Cannes with Portrait, which is not undeserved because it's a brilliant screenplay, but also strikes me as, like, slightly odd and in a pattern of the way that films directed by women have been awarded at Cannes, because just, I think,
or the Oscars.
I mean, the previous year or the year before, Lynn Ramsey's You Were Never Really Here screened at Cannes and won the Screenplay Award, which is probably partially because they also wanted to give the film Best Actor, which you can only do if it also gets screenplay for convoluted reasons. But it's just very strange for that film in particular, because it's
so
a film
obviously
with, like,
a directed
very
film.
Yeah, traditionally people see good screenplays as, like, screenplays with a lot of dialogue, which I think is incorrect. But, like, in that tradition, it's strange that You Were Never Really Here would be awarded as a film with very little dialogue. That's, like, brilliant largely because of, like, the visual and sound elements of the film and the way it's edited and the way those elements, like, have, like, a huge emotional impact on you as a viewer. Like, it's such a director's film. Obviously, it's very well structured as well, but it was a weird award. And the second year with Portrait being such, like, a virtuosic feat of direction for it to be given the Screenplay Award for what is a great screenplay, it seems like a telling pattern to the fact that there's this reluctance to acknowledge women as, like, yeah, we'll acknowledge films women directed, but we're going to acknowledge them as screenwriters rather than as directors, because, like, there's, like, a long-standing, like, thinking that, like, women are just not as visual thinkers as men, and that's why they're not as suited to the film directing profession.
Yeah, I think there's two things going on here. One of them is gendered, and one of them is more about the being a writer-director. So, I mean, I'll just deal with the writer-director one first, because the gendered one is more complicated. But, I mean, something that you and I talk about a lot, Orla, is there are a lot of directors who write their own films who should not. Like, they're really good at directing, but their writing is poor. Like, the flip side of that is, I think if you're a really good writer and you're a director, it's easier to get recognized, or easier for people to overlook the directing. And I think, especially for really good writer-directors, the writing and directing are really intertwined.
I mean, I think Kelly Reichardt is probably an example of this.
And I think, you know, and Kelly Reichardt, because her films are more sparse in dialogue, I think, ironically, even though they're extremely well written, might get less recognized for writing and more recognized for directing, not because the writing is weak, but because they may seem less written. But then, you know, I mean, if we look, you know, just think about the Oscars this year and we think about, like, Worst Person in the World, like, I think it's an excellent screenplay, but if I were going to give it one nomination outside of, aside from the fact that I'm happy to see Eskil Vogt nominated, probably I would have given, like, the one nomination outside of Best International Film would have been for directing, because it's so obviously, like, a heavily directed film that not just anyone could captain that ship.
It's, like, difficult to describe, like, what's good directing. I mean, like, yeah. Like, I know what you mean by heavily directed, but it's also sort of like, you know, a film where you're not just communicating the script, right?
Yeah. Like, well, and it's a film that seems like more obviously most directed, which is not the same as, and maybe the challenge with somebody like Siama or like Andrew Haig is their writing is so good that then their directing is not showy. And so it can be seen as, oh, well, it's a screenplay film. I mean, I think Mia Hansen-Love had this issue too, right? Like, people nominated Bergman Island for writing, but not for directing or, like, best film. I mean, that's a talkie film, so it has there's other things going on with that. But, like, I think, I don't know, I think with, like, I think with Celine Sciamma, Andrew Haig, Alice Winokur, they're all really great writers, and they're maybe even better directors, but they maybe get more recognition for writing. But, yeah, like, I guess kind of what you said, did you say this on the podcast before we were recording, but people don't necessarily know what good directing is. And so if you're the writer and the director, it can be confusing. Like, what is it that I like about this movie? Is it the writing or the directing? And you would think with a film like Dune, although ironically the Oscars didn't recognize it this way, like, it seems more obvious, like, also because the screenplay sucked, but whatever, that's like a directing film, right? Because it's like sci-fi and there's all these moving parts. And so you can see, like, that's a movie that had to be directed. But then, or like 1917, oh, it's all in one take. Like, obviously this is a direction film. But then you look at like Quo Vadis Aida, which is just as incredibly complicatedly choreographed and complex as 1917 and like the European Film Awards acknowledged it for best director, right? But like no one else did.
It's funny that people seem to have this need to put a film in either category when the very best films both are great.
Yeah, like it's hard to have a great film without a great screenplay.
Yeah, and those two things aren't so easily compartmentalized, but people seem to want to do that. And it seems funny to me that someone like Sayama would be put into the screenplay compartment.
Yeah, and then of course for women there's the added challenge of, you know, people thinking that women can't direct. But there's a much longer history of women writing screenplays in Hollywood, right? Like dating way back to the early days. Sort of like how there's lots of women who are editors, the sort of like thankless behind the scene jobs that you don't see without like which I guess directors were in the old days too before auteurist culture.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because an editor is kind of like a bit of a screenwriter. Absolutely. Because you're like chopping up the screenplay after the fact, whereas a cinematographer is like an extension of the director as a visual stylist. And cinematography is a field where women are severely underrepresented historically, but editing is, women have been much better represented throughout history in the film industry in the editing category. So I mean, I mentioned this off the podcast, but what always stuck with me is this like Bret Easton Ellis essay about, which is funny because he basically was like, women can't direct movies, and here's why, the essay. Despite the fact that like American Psycho was directed by a woman, he was like, well, I did like that one. And he basically goes off about how like it's just not in women's nature to like think visually and to think of storytelling in a visual way. And he's like, yeah, and you can say that there's Sofia Coppola, but like her DP's a man. So, and then like, why are you crediting the visual style of all the films by men to the director, but the one by women to her DP? Okay.
yeah.
And Yeah, and his argument was basically just like this, like it's in the genes of women to not think visually, to think more in like novelistic terms. And even though that was about a decade ago, it's not something that you could like say in polite company now. But I think not too long ago, that was a thought that people were publicly having. And it's still kind of, even though we don't see people going around saying women can't think of images anymore, you still see that way of thinking manifesting in different ways, such as like women being more recognized for screenwriting than they are for directing.
Again, awards are a good barometer, not because they tell you anything about what's deserving, but they tell you about what certain people think is deserving. But, you know, like, think of how, like, I am not advocating for Emerald Fennell winning anything, but she was nominated for Best Director and Best Screenplay, and they had to give director to Chloe Zhao, so she got Best Screenplay. But then you've also got, like, just, you know, like, it was pretty radical that women were getting nominated at the Academy. And you think similarly, like, Greta Gerwig was nominated for Best Director for Lady Bird, but instead she... Actually, she didn't win, did she? Get Out won.
No, but then for Little Women, she wasn't nominated for director, but she was for screenplay.
Right.
Even though, that film is also kind of a big directing
feat. Right, but you could see how you could then, because she's a writer-director, classify it as a screenwriting feat, because what she's done is ripped up Little Women and redone it, which is certainly not just in the writing, but very much in how she's directed it, but... Again, she's a woman. She wrote it, so.
And two of its actors got nominated.
Right.
So that was being recognized. But the person who directed a stellar ensemble wasn't.
And, like, I don't even necessarily think that those are the best, most exciting women directors out there. They're just the ones getting recognized by the American Academy. I mean, even Promising Young Woman, like, that screenplay sucked. The direction wasn't as terrible as the screenplay. Probably also depends on, I mean, I think before we started recording, Lindsay was saying, like, people determine who the best director is based on, like, who's most charismatic on the award circuit and can sound, I don't know. You're here, Lindsay. You can, I don't need to quote you. You can say what you were going to say.
Yeah, it's just marketing. It's all just marketing. Who's most palatable? Who's going to present themselves well? How can we use that to sell tickets or make money in some way? Okay, let's elevate that person. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's easy to be disillusioned with that.
And the director, like, as an auteur, is like the personality behind the project. So if you don't have a personality, like, to market, people are less likely to see you as an important director.
Yeah, or if you don't want that kind of attention and go around and be on the press circuit.
Yeah, collaboration further complicates things, because then you're not just a singular figure that they can thrust upon the world and say, they created this amazing thing. When it's credit distributed to multiple people, then it's harder to craft a narrative out of it for the press. I truly think that's it.
Oh, I think also some people are really good at telling their story that makes it sound like all they did was direct versus all they did was write. Like, if you go around talking about how if you go around talking about how improvisational your process is, then people are like, oh, well, you're a director. But I think, I mean, what you're saying, Lindsay, about, like, the fact that with collaboration it's more porous, I think that is one of the challenges with people who wear many hats, is it's hard to know. And the only reason we seem to care about breaking down is because of how credit's given and how awards are given, right? Like, does it matter how much of Passing was directed versus written by Rebecca Hall? Because she did both? Do you ever really stop being a writer or stop being a director in that process? Like, you're thinking about how you're going to direct it as you're writing it. Most directors, anyway, who do both. But, like, you think of, I mean, even, like, yeah, she was a new director and so was Maggie Gyllenhaal last year. And what were they recognized for? Screenplay. And actually, I think those two films are weaker in the screenplay than they were in the directing.
Yeah, I think especially Passing is, like, very much, it made me very impressed with Rebecca Hall as a director, more so than as a screenwriter.
Absolutely. I think the same is true of, I don't think it's as impressively directed, but the same is true of The Lost Daughter. But there's so many things that happen on a film set that are not, that like what you end up getting credited at may or may not really reflect what you're doing.
Well, I mean, Lynn Ramsey has, and he's done this in several other films, but Lynn Ramsey has her editor, Joe Beany, on set as they shoot. And Joe Beany also used to be on set when he would edit Werner Herzog's films.
Right, there,
any of
there's
the fiction,
a great photo
when he edited.
Of him on set in our ebook, Subjective Reality, next to like
yes.
Nick Cage.
Yeah, so when Werner Herzog would make fiction films that he edited, he would be on set as well, which is, and mostly it's just as an observer, but it's just like having people present at various points of the creative process. I mean, while you were saying like, if you're a director and writer, when does one bit of the process end and the other begin? Like, I also think of like Kelly Reichardt as someone who edits her own films. Like, some of the editing is really taking place on set because she might like be looking at the image and thinking, actually, we don't need this shot because I'm playing this in my head. And if I were in like later in the edit, I'd chop this bit out anyway. So let's just not capture it. Like, that kind of thinking happens if you're editing your own films. And I imagine that's one of the benefits of like having Joe Beany on set as well.
Yeah, and when you interviewed like the production designer on Unsane in our ebook Beyond Empowertainment, she was like, there are things that Steven Soderbergh just told me, like, you don't have to do that side of the room because I'm never going to shoot that and I'm never going to cut that into the film. And that's something that like he can do because he edits his own films. But
and shoots
I
them.
Guess part of what I just meant is that like
allegedly.
You mean Peter Andre shoots them. And he doesn't edit them either. It's like Mary something. I can't remember her name.
Is that him?
Yeah, it's him.
Yeah. I'm glad that he's fake employing a woman.
But yeah, I guess I just mean that there's a lot of things that happen. Like even, I mean, anytime you do any kind of collaborative project, there are people doing things that they don't get credit for or that they don't get written credit for. Like I think we talk to a lot of directors, especially women, especially Indigenous women, who end up doing a lot of producing on their film, but they don't get a production credit. And so, I don't know. It's just like, we get really obsessed with these categories, but then it becomes especially complicated because culturally we don't want to see women as leaders. And since directors are literally the captain of the ship, it's like we look for any excuse to find something else to give the women credit for.
We have created a special box set of books that we previously wrote about women who have featured in the Cannes competition. The Women in Cannes competition box set includes books about three women directors who have been selected for the competition over the years. There are also three of our favourite filmmakers, Lynn Ramsey, Celine Sciamma, and this year, Kelly Reichardt. Get your copy of the Women in Cannes competition box set at 7th-row.com/womenatcannes. That's C-A-N-N-E-S. On our Kelly Reichardt ebook, Roads to Nowhere, Kelly Reichardt's Broken American Dreams, Claudio Alves of The Film Experience said, as a Kelly Reichardt fan, I can't recommend Roads to Nowhere enough. On our Celine Sciamma book, Portraits of Resistance, film critic Alfred Soto commented, erudite and casual, Portraits of Resistance will force readers into running back to watch every Sciamma film to see what they missed. On our Lynn Ramsey book, You Were Never Really Here, A Special Issue, Brian Tallarico of RogerEbert.com wrote, Seventh Row's ebook allows for a deeper appreciation of a brilliant piece of art. It's what we want more from critical analysis, a conversation with the art and its creators, but so rarely get. Get your copy of the Women in Cannes competition box set at 7th-row.com/womenatcannes.
I mean, closing thoughts are just that, I mean, I don't know. I like Celine Sciamma. I'm happy her work exists. I wish she got more recognition. I'm glad she got it for Portrait of a Lady on Fire. I don't know if that has meant anything for her career or will have long-term impact on her career, but fingers crossed.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, like, she hasn't really made a film since, like, her first three films since then, because we talked about how Portrait was a bit more romantic and Petite Maman is also a bit sort of an easier watch because it's about childhood and it's quite lovely. And I wonder sort of how it would be received if she made something with the kind of harshness of her first three films.
Yeah, I think Portrait and Petit Mama have a bit of sentimentality that make them go down easier. And I don't know if those films have opened her up to a wider audience that would be receptive to something more challenging. I'm really not sure. It's an interesting thing to think about, though, if her, I don't want to say newfound recognition, but wider audience recognition would allow her to go back to those types of films if she wanted to.
I would guess the answer is she could do them. She just might not make money or get any recognition for them.
That's probably it.
I guess the thing that we didn't say is, to bring this all back to Cannes, is I think one of the challenges of being Celine Sciamma or being a French filmmaker, but especially like being a French kind of like difficult queer. I don't mean she's a difficult woman. I just mean like her films are not like they take some work to watch them in a good way. But the challenges of that is that when you think about how do international directors break out, we talked about this in episode one, Cannes really helps them. The challenge with being a French director at Cannes is, like, a bunch of French films are programmed. You know, that's good for France because it's their festival. They should program lots of French films, just like Berlin programs a bunch of films from Germany and TIFF programs films from Canada that they bury. But anyway, that's a whole other story. But so, like, Celine Sciamma has kind of been in this kind of shitty position through no fault of her work. But, you know, Portrait of a Lady on Fire premiered the same year as Les Miserables. The way the silly Oscars work is countries can submit one film. Mm-hmm. And, like, there are good reasons that Les Miserables was the one that was chosen. Like, I don't love it, but I understand why they would have picked it.
Mm-hmm. And it's also sort of like significant as like, just as women are very underrepresented at Cannes, so are Black directors.
Exactly,
and,
yeah.
And I mean, I like the film quite a bit, so I don't necessarily begrudge that.
Yeah, I don't think it was a bad film either.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it did get chosen over Portrait, which is notable, especially as it's now sort of a pattern with Petite Maman also not being chosen this past year.
Right. Well, and that's because she was up against Palme d'Or winner Julia Ducournau for Titan. Yeah. I mean, arguably those were both bad choices because I actually think Celine Sciamma's two films have broader appeal than either of those films. Mm-hmm. And if France really wanted the Oscar, ironically actually picking Sciamma probably would have gotten them nominations.
Or the third choice on the shortlist was Audrey Diwan's Happening, which is like a very sort of like socially relevant film as a film about abortion, which also probably had a much higher chance of being nominated and won Venice. So I think both of those were like much more palatable to the Oscars than Titan ever was going to be. And predictably, Titan wasn't even shortlisted, let alone nominated for the Oscar.
But that problem of like sudden, like these three, we actually have three feted films by women directors all coming out of France in 1 year, and they have to compete with each other. Mm-hmm. And whichever one doesn't win that competition kind of gets screwed. You know, like Petite Mama has found its audience, but like we could go on about how that distribution was kind of botched.
Well, the distribution was kind of botched with Portrait, because Portrait, if handled well, could have been a breakout. Whether it was nominated for international film or not, it could have done what, say, Worst Person in the World did this past year and, like, be nominated in other categories like screenplay or Drive My Car and director and picture. Like, that was happening with Parasite the same year. And and that potential was absolutely there for Portrait, and it wasn't delivered on.
Yeah, I totally forgot that that was the same year, because that's a fun fact then, that that means that Kelly Reichardt was on the jury that gave Celine Sciamma Best Screenplay.
Yes, connections between our podcast filmmakers.
the Cannes competition with its limit of women. I mean, they don't have an official We Won't program more than four women, but given they've never done it.
Well, except for this year.
Except
they've
gone
the grand total of 4.5.
Yeah. It's like they're competing against each other, and the competition favors French directors among the women that they program. And then once you make it through that hoop, now you have to compete with like the two other women who managed to make it through hoops, and then only one of you gets to have like an internet. What a broken system. It's just where I'm going with this. I mean, it's broken for everyone, but it just feels like extra broken for the women stuck in it.
And if you want to hear more about broken systems, read our book, Portraits of Resistance, The Cinema of Celine Sciamma, all about how Sciamma depicts women who are surviving on broken patriarchal systems and finding brief moments of happiness within them. Sciammabook.com.
You can also listen to episode 1 of this podcast where we talk about why the Cannes Film Festival is broken.
Yes, and also we should mention we are selling a box set right now, which is the Women in the Cannes Competition box set, in which you can discover how three great women directors work and what themes their films explore through an ebook on each of them, all filmmakers who have appeared in the Cannes Competition. So those are Lynn Ramsey, focusing on her film You Were Never Really Here, and then our books on Celine Sciamma and Kelly Reichardt, which we talked about the previous episode. And so that you can get three books for the price of two if you go to 7th-row.com/women-at-can-box-set, and you'll get Portraits of Resistance as part of that bundle. And if you want to listen to more Sciamma content, you can listen to our Petite Maman episode, which Lindsay also features on. That's episode 128 on this podcast feed. And you can also listen to episode 96, our Water Lilies episode, which is an episode in which we compare Water Lilies to Jennifer's Body in their shared explorations of compulsory heterosexuality for teenage girls, to very similar movies. And that's a members only episode, so you'll have to be a member to listen. So you can go to 7th-row.com/join to find out more about that. And then, other than that, please listen to our previous two episodes in this series. Episode 1 about the history of women at Cannes, and episode 2 about Kelly Reichardt, in which we similarly dive into her career in advance of her new film at Cannes. And please tune in next week for our fourth and final episode in this season, which is all about the Queen of Cannes, Naomi Kowase, who has screened at Cannes more times than any other woman. And in this century, she is the third most screened person at Cannes after the Dardennes. And who's the other one?
I think Nuri Bilge Ceylan.
Mm-hmm. And she's like tied with three other people in third place there. Are you sure it's not Ken Loach? It might be.
Oh, he's on the list too, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that all that info is on our... We have a resource page that we'll link in the show notes, which is lists like all the women that have ever screened at Cannes. So please take a look at that if you want some very exciting stats. But we talk about that in episode 1 as well. But yes, we're going to be talking about Naomi Kowase next week, which is very exciting because she is very heralded by Cannes, but still somehow underappreciated. So we're going to talk a bit about that. And I'd suggest that if you want two recommendations for films to watch before you listen to that episode, I'd recommend True Mothers and Still the Water, because we talk about them the most on that episode. And they're both available on the Criterion channel at the moment.
Well, where can people find you, Lindsay? I don't think you've actually said that your site is Woman in Revolt.
It's womaninrevolt.com. All my shit's on there. I have a podcast. I've reviewed some recent films. And yeah, check it out. That's my place.
And of course, you can also be found in the Kelly Reichardt book, Roads to Nowhere.
That's true, too.
Speaking deep truths about Meek's Cutoff, or writing deep truths, I guess. Orla?
You can find me at Orlamango on Twitter. You can find my writing at 7th Row. And you can find me every week on this podcast.
You can find me on Twitter at bwestcineast, bwestcineaste. You can also find all of us on Twitter and Instagram at SevenThrow, SevenThrow, where we will be posting various stats and news and things related to the Cannes Film Festival that will complement what we're doing on the podcast. If you'd like some of that stuff delivered straight to your inbox, you can actually join our mailing list. And if you want specifically the Women at Cannes stuff, that's at email.seventh-row.com/womenatcannes. We'll put a link to that in the show notes.
And if you like this episode, please, please, please rate and review it. We would love to hear from you, and it helps massively. Also, I mean, you can also, if you want to send us a longer thing, you can email us at contact@seventh-row.com and tell us your thoughts about the episode. We would love to, if you're comfortable with it, read out your thoughts on a future podcast episode and share them. And we'd also like, with Cannes going on right now, really love for more people to listen to this season, particularly about women at Cannes, because we think that the conversation about like the way Cannes values or does not value female filmmakers is a really important one to have alongside all the hype that comes with the film festival. I mean, people are sort of like very excited to be at Cannes and to be seeing all the hot new movies. And I understand that, and I think that's fair. But I think, you know, we also need to have the conversation about how the fact that Cannes is such a huge taste-making institution while having so many structural problems about what films it values is like really important to like consistently have alongside that. So we would love to help give some context to that conversation. So please, if you are liking this series, please share it with any individual that you think would be interested, or on social media, and help us spread the word. You can use the hashtag Women at Cannes to do so.
Tune in next week for our Naomi Kawase episode. Thanks for listening.